Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border, coast to coast, and all the ships at sea. Streaming live from the County of Kings, Brooklyn, New York City, on the Heritage Radio Network. Are you ready for the fastest half hour on the internet today? It's the Mike and Judy Show, spanning the globe for high-minded hijinks and lowbrow kicks to bring you the best in sex, drugs, rock and roll, and nuclear fission. Too bad for radio and too good looking for television. And now, here they are, the Nichols and May of the Now Generation, your hosts, Mike Edison and Judy McGuire.
Well, hello, hello, hello.
Hi.
Well, that's not Judy. It's Mike Edison here on the Mike and Judy Show, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network here at Roberta's in Bushwick. And it's punk rock pizza party today, but unfortunately, sans Judy McGuire, who is still recuperating from her book party this week, the best book party of all time for her new book, The Official Book of Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Lists. If you don't have it, please go out and get it right away. No, it's a motherfucker, man. It's
She is still hungover
It's the shit. But sitting in for Judy today is our friend Eric Davidson.
Hi, thanks for having me, Mike.
Who is unfortunately not too hot for television, but is the author of We Never Learn, the Gunk Punk Manifesto.
Yes, Gunk Punk Underground, 1988 to 2001. Mike was my editor. He spent many a sorrowful night having to look at my junk.
I've been outed as the man behind the screen. I am the Wizard of Oz over here.
He is the Wizard of Oz.
Our very special guest today is Mick Collins of the Gorries, and more recently the Dirt Bombs, one of my very, very favorite bands and one of the few survivors of the gunk punk era.
Go ahead and stop using that phrase.
It's questionable whether or not I survived.
Yeah, well, I feel like we're three superannuated punks in this room. And I guess, well, we've been at it for a long fucking time. I mean, the three of us.
That's the first time in my life I heard the phrase superannuated punks.
Well,
it's the first time I've had it applied to me, but unfortunately, it's quite accurate.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate.
Yeah, well, like I say, if the Jew fits.
Hey!
So, no, seriously.
Wait, you're a Jew? I'm Jew-ish.
Mick, how long have you been in this racket? I mean, it's been a while, right? And you're still at it, and actually stronger and better than ever. Your output now, I mean, rivals the first stuff you were doing, which is unlike most of the people who got in this racket.
Thank you. I hung my shingle out in 1980. The first money I got for playing music was in 1980, and then the Gorries didn't form until 6 years later.
And what was the first band like? For those who know the Gorries.
What
was the run-up to the Gorries? I can only imagine.
The band before the Gorries was called the Floor Tasters. And we basically sounded like the first two Wire LPs. That was our sole source of inspiration for what we did.
That's not really the gunk. That's more like the angular sort of post
angular, but punk. Trashy,
yeah, exactly. We were sort of teenage post punks. We were more into the Residents than the Sex Pistols kind of thing, and you know, hardcore that sort of that.
But
that
not
whole.
That Residents record with just whale sounds for 45 minutes. Not that.
It's funny because I never really took you.
Well, I don't know.
I never really took you for an art fag.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I am an art fag. I'm going to out myself right now. I'm an art fag.
I mean, the Gorries are one of those bands whose influence is like much huger than I think the lamestream media, to cop a Sarah Palin-ism, even realizes them. I think you guys had an unbelievable influence on so many people, from Jack White, the Blues Explosion, and just trickled down from there. I mean, you guys had a fucking punch.
I don't really think about it most of the time, but it is true. Like the Blues Explosion told me that they actually met at a Gorries show. Like all three of them were there. The second time the Gorries came to New York City, they were all there.
Well, I love the Gorries. I mean, I think they're one of the best. I mean, I think, you know, it's like you guys were into deep blues as opposed to, say, the Cramps were into rockabilly.
Right. We thought of ourselves as a blues band.
Yeah.
And most people, you know, like, it's rock music, and we didn't have any idea. That's why, you know, I coined the term punk blues, because we were a punk-inflected blues band as opposed to any kind of a rock band. Like, those sort of the early garage rock comps that were just starting to come out, like Nuggets and that, mm-hmm. Scum of the Earth and that. those were just starting to happen when we were around. Apart from those, we really only listened to like Chess Blues and you know, like Lomax recordings and that kind of thing. And our main inspiration were blues artists.
Now, I remember you were telling me that when I interviewed Mick for my damn book, you were telling me that stuff. But what was Detroit at the time? Like, what was Detroit like as far as being able to get a show, say 87, 88,
around that time? It was completely wide open. I mean, that's the thing. You could get a show anywhere. I mean, you know, we because we thought of ourselves as a blues band, we couldn't get shows in blues clubs.
Well, no.
No, because they're looking for the happy horseshit yeah, hour.
Exactly.
You know, like the Michelob Hammer style of blues, the Johnny Carson
exactly,
style.
Yeah, they wanted, yeah, they good wanted times, Michelob
good blues, friends. Right. These times are made yeah, for Michelob. No, it's bullshit.
Blues Hammer.
Yeah. Yeah, we were a little too abrasive for that sort of thing, but you could get shows. I mean, there were plenty of outlets for a small local band to play. That was, you know, that actually is really, more than anything else, that worked in our favor more than anything else, because you could always get a show somewhere. There was a place called Reruns. You could always play Reruns. You could always
was it named
play.
After the guy in What's Happening?
I don't think, you know, I've wondered about that over the years. I'm not actually
where,
sure.
Where did What's Happening take place?
Was it Philly? Pittsburgh?
Maybe Philly?
Okay, this question's maybe going Philly. Nowhere.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry.
Well, no, it's interesting you say that.
But
because
I think about it just as, you know, this, you know, the, with these classic urban comedies.
Right.
You know, and why
I never
why
knew where that
I was just talking was about at. 227 yesterday. Where did 227 take place? Doesn't matter. Anyway.
That's not an area code, right? Yeah, it's not like the comedy that is the 313.
227 definitely took place in East New York.
But it's funny you say that, because in my book, it seemed like every musician that I interviewed whose band formed before about 1990 or 91, everyone except for you, complained that their town, if you wanted to do original music, there was no place to play. That everybody wanted cover bands or blues bands or bands doing hits of the day or DJs playing disco. They all complained. And anybody after 1991, the whole DIY thing kicked in, and every band had at least like a house show or a dive
see,
bar.
In Detroit, it was you could play. There were many
same
places
with Cleveland.
To play. They were open mic. There were venues, like one, the first place the Gorys ever played was a church that had an open mic night, like in there. They had like this room
out
back.
Was it a working church or a closed
church? No, it was a working church.
Okay, yeah.
And they had this thing, like a concert series, where you could go and you signed up, and you know, and then when the time came along, it's okay, you guys go on at 10:30. 10:30, you set up and you play.
But did you have to sit in a confessional or do something like that?
No. You went out back, and they had like food, you know. It was like you kind of sat. It was like a supper club almost, and you had no idea. And they put like solo acts and folk acts on first, and then around about 11 o'clock or so, they put on bands.
Yeah,
like that night, the first night we ever played, the act that went on right before us was Rob Tyner playing solo auto harp.
Oh, yeah, I remember you telling
me. Yeah, crazy. So he did a bunch of like Vietnam protest songs. This was 1986.
Yes, I guess he didn't get that memo.
Yeah. So,
well, listen, speaking of playing in churches, guys, I want you to think of the Mike and Judy Show as your confession booth.
Oh, very nice.
I've sinned.
Well, then I want to have like a screen in front of me so I can't see you, Mike, and I can just tell you all my horrible lies.
I'll tell you what about.
I used to lie to priests all the time in confession. I lied to priests.
Really? What kind of lies? Like sins that
well,
you wanted to do that you aspired
to?
Or lie like, no, I haven't jerked off. No, I didn't fuck that whore. No, I didn't do those.
Oh,
drugs.
It was pathetic.
Or like, you know, forgive me, Father, for I have like, you know.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. My sins are. And then I would say like, I would be like, well, I swore at my parents. And the priest, being creepy, would say, what were the swear words? And I said, and instead of saying fuck or cock or whatever, I would say, I said damn. And he's like, that's not so bad. You know, I say damn from the pulpit. And then it became very weird, you know. And then so in those conversations, went nowhere.
You never wanted to tell the priest that you set somebody's house on fire. So you made something else up. You just, you know.
I used to make napalm. I did used to make napalm with my friend, where you put gas in styrofoam cups and mix it together, and it turns into like napalm. And we used to dump that on top of churches.
Well, you guys are like Midwest. You got a lot of free time out there.
Yes, we do. A lot of free time.
A lot of free time.
You got free time.
Buildings to burn.
That's right. And you got what we didn't have in New York, and that's like garages. Okay.
Yes.
You know,
actual
and cars.
Garages.
Yes,
actual garages.
You know?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, playing New York is so difficult to play in, because it's just not a friendly town for musicians. I haven't even set up my drums in years. I have my drums set up in my storage space. I've set them up more times in Paris than I have in New York. It's just not a fucking friend. No, because I take them on the road as they play them in a club, but to play them in New York, where the fuck am I going to go?
Yeah, exactly.
And set up my drums.
But don't you think there's something about that, that I've lived in New York for a while now, and I got this new band, Livids, by the way. That's my new band. A little plug. Don't you think there's something about that that kind of does force you to concentrate
on
your music?
It makes you fucking harder. Let me tell you something. something. Yeah, when we started up playing, that's right, Detroit. Listen to this. All right? Because when we started, to be in a band, the barrier to entry, was so great because studios were expensive. Well, I mean, now there's a lot a lot more people playing music, and recording studios were very expensive.
It's still expensive.
And difficult to use, but it was like crazy. And they weren't set up to do a million punk rock records. Right. It's good because people got better as records became, better recorded and the technology caught up.
Sure.
But let me tell you something. To put together a show and to rehearse and to get the four people together, you had no cars and travel on subways and how you get your gear to the gig. And then to promote the gig, you're putting up flyers and you're running around town and you're risking getting, arrested and whatnot. It's fucking hard in New York, man. You can't play loud anywhere. You got to pay for it. Nobody has a basement. No one has a car.
When Ranch Hands would play, did you guys end up like borrowing and equipment with other opening bands and things, or did you really drag all your fucking phones on a subway?
You try to swap in New York always, and then now clubs are getting a little smarter and have like some sort of formula of backline. Let me tell you something. In Sharky's Machine, my first band of any note in New York, we took our shit to gigs to CBGBs in shopping carts we'd ripped off from the Grand Union on Lafayette Street.
Nice.
And that's actually how we got our first record is Kramer of Shimmy Disc.
Yeah.
We went to this place, No Say No, but he saw us wheeling our shit to a gig, literally a bass drum, a bass guitar, a fucking cabinet in three shopping carts, which we locked up with bicycle locks outside the fucking club on Livingston Street. And that's how we got to the gig.
And
he was
awesome.
So fucking impressed. He was like, you offered us a contract on the spot.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty cool.
Recently we just had to live through this thing called the CBGB's Festival, which to me was kind of scary because it was a lot of people trying to claim authenticity. When they really had no contact point with the true thing
itself.
Never played there or really understood what the zeitgeist of CBGB's was, which was what you were talking about before. And I think what a place like Don Pedro's sort of became, here in Bushwick and other places, we play places that let us play.
Right.
Yeah.
That's it.
Right.
Can we play here? Yes. And it turned into a scene. It wasn't this vision of Hilly, who's a great guy and was able to foster this, but it wasn't I love your band, the Ramones and Television and Blondie and the Talking Heads, who actually stylistically have nothing to do with each other.
Right.
But he let them play and let them build their scene there and was, smart enough to let it happen. And have a culture created. Because you can't buy culture.
Which is
what the CBGB's thing is trying to do. It's why I'm against. I feel like I'm being co-opted. Every time I see that fucking brand somewhere.
Absolutely.
Well, they literally said, the guys that took it over literally said something like, this festival, we may not even do it again. It's just they literally said reintroduce the brand. And it's like, okay, whatever.
Yeah, they actually
said that. I'm trying to be open-minded here, but it's like reintroduce the brand. It's like, why? Like what? And the bands kind of didn't make sense. It was a weird mix. I was out of town anyway. I went to a wedding in Akron, Ohio.
I boycotted, man. And no offense to any of the bands who played, I personally like, but every time I was like, ooh, we're playing the CBGB's festival. It upsets me. CBGB's was a great place to play. Did you ever get to play there, Mick?
The Dirt Bombs played there once, and Blacktop actually played there once.
Blacktop, but
the Dirt Bombs did play there. We had a really great show there.
Isn't it a great place
to play? The three times the Turks played there, I had as good of a time as any other show. I had one of my top three favorite shows ever. I mean, it was definitely, it sucked to have to take a whiz. I mean, that's but otherwise, that's it was awesome. Just like,
well, whiz was a joy.
But it was
I just went outside. Yeah. I thought the outside second it was cleaner.
I loved the installation known as the CBGB's.
Well, I'm coming from Ohio. It sounds corny as hell, but definitely when you stood on stage, you're like,
brute.
Hey, the Ramones played here and blah, 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 and you were standing there. But not just all that, but it was actually a fun club. Like, one of these
the
joints.
Stage at CBGB's, if you got a good sound check, no stage ever sounded that good. It had its own sound.
I saw the Liars play there, and they were incredible.
Great fucking room. But at the end, when CBGB's was really fading, the truth is the club itself wasn't booking competitively.
Oh, for at least
they weren't booking
years.
Anybody.
At least,
and no one played there. I mean, the other clubs that have come and gone, like Coney Island High, were getting the gigs. That's where we went to play. That's where the Ron Chans would play. When you came to town, it's where you all play. And clubs come and go. But CBGB's was there and wasn't doing anything to foster it. And didn't really want to save their own club. So when this whole hullabaloo of Save CBGB's came up, it's like, man, the fuckers who own this place don't want to save it because they make more money in the t-shirt business.
Right.
I don't blame Hilly for not wanting to do it, but I think that there was something that was not in good faith about
that. I remember seeing people get up at some of these Save CBGB shows a few years ago, and after they would give some speech about how we should save CBs, I'd ask them, when's the last time you went to see a show there? And it was literally like 7 years.
Right.
It was just like years, And I still was going to see shows there once in a while, but, it is what it is. Clubs move on. It's
I'm
all right,
not crazy about what's been happening to the Bowery, but change is inevitable. Manhattan has always been about change, and I find that people who protest at Munts are the ones that have done the least to affect it. Yeah. All right. We have a great treat because we have the new Dirt Bomb single that we're going to spin today. You want to set it up for us, Mick? Tell us what the story is.
This is the first single off the new album, which is entitled Ooey Gooey Chewy Kablooey. It is an
Which is Yiddish for what again?
Yeah. The album is an homage to, to classic bubblegum music of the late 60s, early 70s.
As opposed to the non-classic
Bubblegum, right.
The all really right. crappy bubblegum.
So this track is called Crazy For You, and there's a lot of Saturday mornings watching Scooby-Doo that went into this record.
All right, Joe, spin it. You're listening to the Mike and Judy Show. You're on the Heritage Radio Network. Here's the Dirt Bombs.
Strange, everything is spinning round and round. Really kind of funny, yeah. My whole world is upside down. You did this to me. You're the only thing I see. But I feel so free. I may be crazy, but it's only 'cause I'm crazy for you. But it's only 'cause I'm crazy for you. Taking over my mind, turning it on a dime. But I just don't wanna get it right. Girl, you're not a doctor, but I love your love and care. You got the power, and I feel it everywhere. There's nothing else to do. I surrender to you. I feel so brand new. I may be crazy, but it's only 'cause I'm crazy for you. I may be crazy, but it's only 'cause I'm crazy for you. Taking over my mind, turning me on a dime. But I just don't wanna get right. I heard voices in my head, but I didn't care what they said. I'm going for you instead. Yeah. You're not a doctor, but I love your love and care. The power, yeah, and I feel it everywhere. There's nothing else to do. I surrender to you. I feel so brand new. I may be crazy, but it's only 'cause I'm crazy for you. I may be crazy, but it's only 'cause I'm crazy for you. Taking over my mind, turning me on a dime. But I just don't wanna get right. I may be crazy, but it's only 'cause I'm crazy for you. I may be crazy, but it's only 'cause I'm crazy for you. I said I may be crazy, but it's only 'cause I'm crazy for you.
All right, we're back on the Mike and Judy Show here streaming live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's and Bushwick. It's Mike Edison, and sitting in for Judy McGuire is Eric Davidson.
Hey!
Author of We Never Learn. Truer words have ne'er been spoke.
Never.
Right, Mick Collins?
We never learn.
Why the fuck are you still doing it?
I don't know, man. I just, I probably reached a couple of good places where I could have stopped, and I didn't.
Well, you're kicking ass. I mean, you're doing great. The Dirt Bombs are such a fantastic band. I mean, really, right out of the gate with Ultra Glide and Black, I mean, you guys made a hardcore statement. That was a great rock and roll record.
Oh, thank you.
But like I said, a lot of us haven't been able to walk through that door and keep on playing.
Right.
What's the secret, dude?
You know what? I don't have an answer for that. You know, my original vision for the Dirt Bombs was we were only going to make 7-inch EPs, and then there were only going to be like 15 of them, and then I was done. And then at some point, the money got really good. Like, people started coming to shows. Like, I wasn't expecting that. Because this
isn't that weird when people actually come to shows?
Yeah. I mean, this was an art project. It wasn't a band. Like, I didn't get together and say, I'm going to have a band and make records. It was like, this was an art project. I'm going to put together this weird idea for this, you know, to make music, make a bit of music, and then call it quits. And then people started showing up at shows, and the money got really good. I was like, well, I don't want to stop now because I'm actually, you know, paying my bills kind of thing with it.
Yeah.
And I just didn't stop.
You stayed on the road for a long time with the Dirt Bombs.
Yeah, I did. In 2008, we did 150 some shows.
Wow.
And you finally moved out of the beloved Detroit to New York City.
I did.
What was the decision-making process in that there?
I met a woman who wouldn't move to Detroit.
Ah, stories that start with, I met a girl.
And she go on the road with you guys?
Story.
She what?
Does she go on the road with you guys?
Oh, no. Well, once. She went to
see,
Ireland with
oh,
us.
Oh, I like, oh, no. You see, that's the correct response.
That is the only
because
answer.
It changes the dynamic, you know. We love our girlfriends, you know, our wives. Of course we do.
What girl wants to sit in a van for 8 hours talking about pooping?
Exactly. You know, nobody knows.
First of all, I don't want to sit in a van for 8 hours talking about pooping.
And yet we do. Why is that?
Pooping in Ramon's bootlegs. What girl would want to do that?
You know, I've been trying to change the dynamic a little bit as we get a little bit older. So, I mean, take your new single finds you in a mellow mood.
Yeah, well, you know, mellow-ish, I guess. For the one record, you know, again, it's like, you know, it was an idea that had been kicking around for a long time, and I joked about doing a bubblegum album, so finally I was like, well, why don't you just make the bubblegum record? So finally I just decided...
Well, maybe not so mellow if you eat a bunch of Pixie Sticks and chew bubblegum while listening to it.
Oh, yeah.
And you get really crazy like right. Bart and Melhouse when they went running around town with all that sugar high. Yeah, like, do that, you know?
Sugar high. It's one of the many vices that I really wasn't into the whole time we were out doing it. It's like sugar. At least not the kind that came out of a Pixie Stick.
Sugar pales in comparison to what Mike usually did in Spain, which was my question for you, Mr. Edison, if you don't mind me asking.
Lay it on me. I've got no secrets.
Connected to my book, We Never Learned the Gunk Punk Undergut, 1988 to 2001. You lived in Spain for a while. You had a crazy-ass punk rock band with a giant singer who was crazy.
Yeah.
And asked me to touch his hernia a number of times the last time I saw him. Why do you think most of the bands in my book seem to all do better in general as far as getting paid and being able to tour in Europe? Why do you think that
is? We always did. Starting out with Sharky's Machine, my first band, and then later when I was in the Wrong Chance, they'd pretty much given up touring in the States because it was too expensive. And, you know, you don't get the respect. I mean, it's harder to get guarantees.
Right.
You certainly don't get a place to crash. You go to Europe and, you know, part of the deal is you get a place to crash and you get food. Right?
Absolutely.
I mean, even, you know, we're not rock stars, but we show up and there's a deli platter waiting for us and there's beer waiting for us and we get treated as musicians with respect, as artists.
It was always great. Like, we'd show up and there'd be a deli tray and we just drove 4 hours. We're like, food! So you eat all the deli tray and then like 10 minutes later they go, dinner is in an hour? Well, and you're like, wait, I just ate this deli tray. And then you eat way too much and then you puke on stage.
Well, the crazy thing was, you know, when I was in Spain playing with the Pleasure Fuckers, and even towards the end of the Wrong Chance, we got really good at this whole concept of like eating food in Europe because Europe's a wonderful place to eat. Every region has a specialty,
right.
And if you know the right guy, they want to show it to you.
Right.
Exactly. So traveling around France, you know, if we're in the south and we're in Bordeaux, we're going to drink the Bordeaux, we're going to have the local cuisine.
Excellent.
If we're in the north
right.
of Spain and Basque Country, we're going to eat big fucking steaks and sepia en su propio tinta and drink the Ribera del Duero.
That's right.
And people ask me, you know, why'd you stay, you know, in Spain for 3 years? You know, was it the drugs? Was it the sex? I'm like, no, it's the white anchovies. You know? I mean, because I couldn't fucking get one anywhere else in the world.
We actually played with the white anchovies in Spain one time.
But los boquerones.
Yeah. Their first DP was awesome.
But what I always say about whenever this topic comes up with all of our pals, we always say how great it was touring Europe and the food and everything else, and then I always say, but who's your favorite band from Utrecht? So there's something about America that comes up with great rock and roll.
I don't recall Buddy Holly being from Paragon. You know what I'm saying? Chuck Berry's not from fucking Paris.
No, we live
in the land of rock and roll.
This is
and, you know, indigenous language, you know, that we have here of rock and roll. And, you know, from New York and from Detroit, you know, and from Ohio.
Cleveland, Ohio.
I mean, geez Louise. I mean, we all were, you know, part of some pretty fertile breeding ground,
right.
You know, for this very distinctly American vernacular. I think when we started, it was easier because there weren't so many bands touring at the time, and we sort of got a leg up.
There's a lot of isolation, too.
Mm-hmm. This is like the pre-internet, you know.
Right.
And which is what your book is about. The Gunk Punk era is the pre-internet days, the last pre-internet days.
Totally, yeah.
How the fuck did we ever do anything without a cell phone?
You do think about it, like, all the traveling we did. Every friend that I know, if we're just walking down the street now, like, we're where's that bar three blocks from here? And somebody pulls out a phone and starts looking for the bar, and it's like, it's only three blocks, let's just keep walking.
How many times did you get lost walking around some hill town in France where you played, you know, a great gig where you couldn't find your way back to the hotel, couldn't find the club? We're trying to drive the van up to the club, which is only like a block away, but because of the kooky streets you couldn't find it, and you don't have a phone, and there's no phone in the club, and you don't, you know, and you can't call the guy.
You're away from the club, but you can't get there because you don't know how to make the five left-hand turns and two rights it takes to get there.
Yeah, especially if Tim Warren is driving your van. Really quick, I tell this quick one. When we were at this show, it was somewhere in Germany, and Tim Warren runs Crypt Records. All of us have been involved with Crypt Records.
Crypt Alumni Show.
Crypt Alumni Show. And it was this club, and so Tim's backstage, and he's getting increasingly hammered, and it's probably only like 8 o'clock, you know. But
typical Tim Warren.
Yeah, and he's getting really hammered, and he's hilarious.
His favorite band was the Ronchans, and for 7 years he never saw us because he never was able to stay conscious.
Exactly.
He's got a Ronchans tattoo, signed us, put out the records, and never actually saw the band because he kept passing out.
Tim would always show up at a show, and then he'd be passed out backstage, like, and you'd go back after your show. Tim, what do you think of the show? He's just lying there grumbling about the Grateful Dead, how much he hates them. And so he's backstage, and there was this biker couple, this German biker couple with the leather pants and the Motorhead shirt or whatever. And they're very nice, and they're very sweet. And Tim's like, fucking hippies, you screwed up everything, you goddamn hippies. You know, and he's yelling at this nice little biker couple. And they did nothing wrong. They were just sitting there. But they had the sin of having long hair and you know, hippie t-shirts or whatever. So he's yelling at them, and he's increasingly getting drunk. I'm like, Tim, just get out of here, because soon enough the biker guy is going to be mad, right? So Tim just leaves the room, and the biker couple couldn't have been nicer. And then later we can't find Tim anywhere. And suddenly I'm putting my bag up in the top little hatch in the van, and I shove my bag. I'm like, why can't I get my bag in there? And Tim is passed out. Yes, exactly. The president of my record label is passed out in the fucking van. I'm like, Tim, man, everyone's been looking for you. Like, Meek is freaking out. Where's Tim? And he's like, and literally he said this. He rolled over and he goes, fucking God, Grateful Dead fuckers. You know, that's all he said. I go, Tim, just wake up. And I go, just get up and get out of the fucking hatch. And then 20 minutes later, I go in, I pee, we get our shit out of there. Tim is sitting in the driver's seat with his sunglasses on. Let's go, Daddy, let's go. Let's hit the Autobahn. I want to drive. I'm like, Tim, I just woke you up from a hippie-hating induced dream, and now you want to drive like 4 hours.
Never a good idea.
No.
Well, Crypt Records was a very unique experiment.
A great man.
Experiment is a good euphemism, yes.
But, you know, but I mean, Tim had it right. I mean, the guy's got good fucking taste.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, the three of us, you know, they're above the grace of Tim. But, I mean, the truth is, I mean, Tim liked Crazy. He liked bands that were fucked up, that drank, that did drugs, that did speed, that really knew how to put it on, and, you know, did not play nice. We didn't play nice.
I always say about Tim, compared to most label guys you ever meet, not all of them, but most, you more felt like you were hanging out with a band guy who was like talking about records and sort of like getting drunk and talking about girls at the bar or whatever, rather than sort of like discussing how we're going to distribute the record or whatever. Right. That might have helped actually sometimes, but
I think of a couple instances where that would have been a much better discussion than what the red light district of Hamburg was like.
Oh, he was the most fun ever to hang out with.
You know, I'll give you my favorite Tim Warren story.
Let's hear it.
As we relate the Crypt record saga. By the way, did you ever get any of the famous faxes from Tim Warren?
Oh, I have. I still have God, many, so many of my that's the book that he's faxes in,
right?
From Tim. Somebody should make a book of those.
Those faxes.
I had two faxes that I wanted to put in my book, and Tim said, I'd rather not have those.
With stick figures of Tim, like, this is what I'm doing right now. And he's like throwing stickers of him throwing eggs at hookers outside his window on the Reaper.
When we first went to L.A., he drew a map of L.A. and it said, like, take a right at the crack whore.
And there, was a picture of the crack whore that he thought picture of the crack whore. We were playing in Groningen at the Vera Club, everybody's favorite clubs.
Great club.
All of
maybe one of the best clubs in all the world.
Right, loved it there. I'm fortunate I got to play there three times with three different bands. I was at Sharky's Machine and came back later with the Ronchans and later with the Pleasure Fuckers. But we're there with the Ronchans. We're on the roll with 9 Pound Hammer, another great Tim Warren Crypt band.
Yeah.
And Tim,
he signed them the same time he signed the
Tim Wayne was like so hot on getting this like Dutch booking agent to work with the label. He's like, you guys got to be on good behavior tonight.
Tim's telling you to be on good behavior.
And the band was like smoking. This was like our 40th gig, you know, with like two nights off, you know. And we were like on fucking fire. We had our shit so nailed down tight. And it was the best we've ever been, right? Don't worry about it. And of course, we put it over like gangbusters. But what's happening is Tim, who says behave yourself, meanwhile, is like snorting speed, you know, like a pit bull floor with a chew rag. Right. Okay. He's drunk as shit. When we got off stage, people were like banging bottles on the edge of the stage to get us to come back on. Sure. A bottle broke. Tim got cut. So now he's covered in blood. He's got white powder all over his nose. And then somehow someone managed to draw a Hitler mustache on him with a Sharpie. So Tim's walking around covered in blood and white powder with a Hitler mustache, right? The story ends up with him in jail, by the way.
And also, of course, it does. The cops came in the next morning. He was passed out. He had the Hitler mustache.
No, they went up to his hotel and dragged him out of the fucking shower because he had tried to rip a parking meter out of the ground later that night because he didn't have enough change with the parking meter. So he got into an argument with the parking meter, and yeah, having failed, went back up to the hotel and got his ass absolutely dragged out of the shower. Where I guess, you know, which was probably like the scene in Psycho with the blood circling around the drain. A scene I had seen many times touring with Gigi Allen, but we'll save that for another show. But next day, back on the road.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
The show must go on.
That's the thing about him. He would wake up, 3 hours later, he was always awake, always drinking coffee, and ready to go.
So the show must go on. What's that next for the Dirt Bombs, Mick?
Well, the record comes out, the full length comes out in January. There's going to be a couple more singles between now and then. And the record comes out in January. And then sometime in 2013, we're going to be touring like crazy.
Yeah. 150 gigs a year.
Gonna be another 150 gigs,
fucking,
man.
Fucking core, daddy-o.
Yeah.
You got any shows coming up before then? Anything you want to tell the kids about?
The Gories are playing in Spain.
Right on.
In October. Dirt Bombs are playing All Tomorrow's Parties.
Also,
this September.
Also a good time. And once again, it's been the fastest 30 minutes on the internet.
Yes, very fast.
I want to thank you, Eric Davidson.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having us.
The Gunk Punk Manifesto, We Never Learn. Mick Collins, the Dirt Bombs, and of course, the Gorillaz, two of my very favorite bands.
Happy to be here.
All right, man. For Judy McGuire, I'm Mike Edison here on the Heritage Radio Network.
And this is a new Bomb Turk song coming up. My fine old band that I had many, many years of fun
and
with.
You guys just roll a little bit, right?
Once in a while, we play. We were supposed to play in Spain this summer.
You know why, Eric?
Why?
Because you never fucking learn.
I never learn.
All right. Here's the new Bomb Turks. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our programs archived on our website or by searching iTunes for Heritage Radio Network. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website.
Thanks for listening.